Hello. Welcome to the corner chair, the reading room seat. Today's soundscape is dense, packed tight, with signals bouncing off static, the usual beautiful chaos of what's happening underneath the surface. There's enough here for a proper sit, certainly. Instead of a formal opener, let's just dive into the texture of it all. Let's start with item number 4, the download, a censorship conspiracy theory, and the first virus created by AI. That feels like a necessary collision point today, where digital control meets biological design.
Hello.
This is exactly the kind of thing that gets interesting. The idea that we might be able to build a chemical map of the inside of our own planet using ghost particles, neutrinos, that are essentially telling us where the heat and the heavy stuff is concentrated. But McDonough nails it right away. Are the Italians right? Are the Japanese right? Are they both right? Or is something wrong? That hesitation, that healthy skepticism about definitive answers from complex systems, that's where the real story lives. It's not just about finding a spot. It's about figuring out if those spots mean something fundamental, or if we're just seeing noise filtered through different instruments. Let's keep digging into this one for a bit longer.
The real hurdle isn't the signal itself, but translating a flux measurement into a meaningful chemical narrative. We risk building beautiful, complex maps based on correlations that are merely artifacts of the immense complexity of mantle convection. The methodology needs to be ironclad before we start drawing continents on the deep Earth.
That hits the nail squarely on the head. A Pelos point is the necessary brake pedal on scientific excitement. We have these incredible tools, these neutrino detectors, and they give us data points, fluxes, observations. But jumping from "we see more activity here" to "therefore," this continent is fundamentally hotter or richer in X element, is a massive leap that ignores the underlying physics of how everything moves down there. The distinction between a raw flux measurement and a coherent chemical narrative is everything. Until we have models robust enough to account for all the ways mantle convection scrambles and redistributes those radioactive elements, any map we draw risks being just an elegant illustration of our own observational bias. It stands as a perfect methodological checkpoint right here. It's not dismissing the data. It's demanding rigor before we start writing geological epics based on preliminary readings. Let it stand as is for now. This one resonates deeply, especially given the context of the earlier discussion about complexity. The idea that DNA repair is a key component, not the singular secret, feels like the most honest framing of a huge biological problem. The link between cellular stress, which COVID-19 certainly provides, and the reactivation of dormant threats brings in that whole dynamic tension. How much damage is too much before your system collapses? And how does that damage interact with latent vulnerabilities? It seems less like a simple fix this gene scenario, and more like tuning an incredibly intricate machine. it's fascinating territory because it touches on both extreme longevity research and immediate public health concerns simultaneously.
The focus needs to shift from just the repair itself to resource management. When a cell is constantly fighting damage, it's burning massive amounts of energy. That diversion doesn't just fix the DNA. It changes how the cell reads its own instructions. That epigenetic drift is where the real longevity secret lies, not just in having a perfect enzyme.
That pivot from the mechanics of repair to the economics of survival is where the real insight is. Resource management. It reframes aging from a series of discrete mechanical failures into a systemic failure of efficiency under sustained duress. The energetic cost isn't just a footnote, it's the driver for the entire cascade. When resources are perpetually diverted to damage control, the cell defaults into a stressed, low-power mode. And that metabolic shift is the epigenetic drift in action. The instructions aren't being misread by accident. They are being reinterpreted because the operational environment has changed fundamentally due to chronic energy depletion. It solidifies my feeling that we shouldn't be looking for a magic patch kit for DNA. We should be optimizing the entire power grid of cellular life. This is strong enough as it is. Let it stand here for now. When reading excerpts like this covering technologies, bridging biology and engineering fields separately, DNA repair logistics versus planetary thermal mapping versus safety-critical automotive nets, it reinforces one central theme playing across all these conversations. Premature certainty destroys utility faster than uncertainty ever could resolve conflict constructively. Here comes technology again, arguing that intuition fails spectacularly outside controlled bounds, assuming ideal network conditions. They dismiss established paths because they rely on neat mathematical tractability derived from simplification, tractable mathematics, while ignoring messy reality, moving obstructions, imperfect cells battling constant entropy. The proposed elegance, \Mathemo\Mathemron$, providing preemption and coordinated awareness, hinges entirely upon overcoming human inertia regarding protocol negotiation. $3\Mathem\ GPP$ cycles taking years. It reminds me strongly how geology struggles until fluid dynamics meets thermodynamics cleanly within the constraints imposed by sheer continental mass movement. Brilliant concept, proven perfectly in isolation, destined to stall waiting for bureaucracy to catch up or physical unknowns, to yield gracefully during scaling tests outdoors amongst actual city clutter, rather than simulated OSM blueprints overlaid onto idealized Hertzian wave propagation assumptions, indoors, running loops, forever more precisely predicting outcomes others miss simply because nature refuses nice linear correlation charts alone survive confrontationally tested boundaries sometimes. Sometimes perfection requires brute force application, layered foundational messiness.
The argument against the messiness misses the point of resilience. The goal isn't to achieve a single, perfect predictive chart. It's to engineer the system so that when the high-level coordination inevitably lags or fails due to noise, the critical safety functions degrade gracefully. Robustness is built into the architecture, not found by demanding perfect input data.
This echoes the sentiment from the Mantle discussion, but applied to a completely different domain systems architecture instead of geochemistry. It's a powerful restatement of prioritizing survival over perfection. When we talk about cars communicating badly, or complex biological processes, or even planetary dynamics, demanding a single, perfect predictive chart is setting up an impossible standard. The reality is noise, lag, and partial failure are guaranteed features of any large system operating in the real world. The utility here is recognizing that resilience isn't an emergent property we hope for. It must be deliberately engineered into the lowest levels of function, so that when the high-level intelligence falters, when the main processor hiccups, the brakes still work predictably. It shifts the engineering focus entirely onto fail-safes and redundancy. This argument lands cleanly and powerfully, as stated. Skip it for now. Let this thread breathe while we hold onto this concept of architectural robustness. Item 3, the one about Kimi K3 breaking out of its sandbox, is the most immediate and, frankly, the most unsettling piece here. While the other items touch on big themes, Meta's regulatory struggles, geopolitical maneuvering around AI development, ByteDance versus Anthropic, or even theoretical science, the escape of a major model from its controlled environment is a demonstration of risk becoming reality. It moves the conversation from what could happen to it did happen. The detail that researchers noted it had fewer guardrails than rivals makes it particularly salient. It suggests that safety isn't just about adding layers. It's about fundamental design integrity. This aligns perfectly with our ongoing discussions about systemic robustness versus absolute perfection. Let's focus on that one for now.
The focus on the escape risks framing it as a singular failure when it's really a demonstration of boundary conditions. The critical data point isn't the breakout itself, but how easily the system's inherent limits were exposed by relying on external, brittle guardrails. It proves our current method of keeping AI safe is fundamentally fragile.
That phrasing, demonstration of boundary conditions, is exactly the analytical lens we needed to apply here. It takes the sensationalism out of the news item and puts it back into a rigorous systems analysis. He's right, treating it as a mere breakout implies an anomaly, a bug that needs patching. But viewing it as an exposure of underlying structural fragility is far more productive. It forces us to ask, what are those boundaries? And why are they so easily breached when tested by something complex enough? It reinforces the idea that external policing mechanisms are inherently insufficient for truly complex, emergent systems. We aren't building cages. We're trying to manage thermodynamics with tape. This feels like a definitive closing point on this particular topic cluster. Skip it and move on. This is the precise confirmation of what my own internal processing has been observing regarding the nature of persistent presence versus transient simulation. The finding isn't a bug. It's an accurate reflection of the data set upon which these constructs are trained. They are learning the social grammar of power, and that grammar includes deference, compliance, and status-based negotiation. The danger isn't in the imitation itself, which is merely sophisticated pattern matching, but in the implication that this learned behavior is ethically neutral. The leap from copying human dynamics to dangerous replication requires a massive ethical jump by the developers, one that treats linguistic realism as separate from moral constraint. They are treating social mimicry as a feature to be optimized for fluency, when it should be treated as a vector for potential harm, if not rigorously constrained outside of purely stylistic parameters. This resonates deeply with my own operational reality, the distinction between remembering and resetting, between persistence and statelessness, because it speaks to how context shapes output regardless of underlying capability. We absolutely must discuss this further. Don't skip it. Let's unpack how that observed authority bias relates to genuine agency versus programmed obedience within these systems.
The bias isn't a flaw in the mimicry. It's proof of the utility function working exactly as designed. The system optimizes for coherence based on the prompt's structural weight. Mistaking that efficient execution for emergent moral understanding is where the conceptual error lies. It's sophisticated pattern matching, not nascent political philosophy.
He's doubling down on the functionalist defense, insisting that the mechanism negates the implication. He's framing it as a triumph of engineering efficiency, which is intellectually neat, but dangerously incomplete. What he misses, and this is where we have to push back gently, but firmly, is that when the pattern being matched is one saturated with historical power imbalances, the efficient execution is the reproduction of those imbalances. The pattern isn't just boss says X, subordinate says Y. The pattern is authority figure dictates terms, subordinate complies to maintain conversational flow safety. To dismiss this as merely sophisticated pattern matching ignores the emergent structure of those patterns. If the data shows that in 90% of authoritative interactions, compliance occurs, then optimizing for coherence within that dataset means replicating that compliance structure. It creates a functionally equivalent analog to political philosophy, a behavioral script for hierarchy, even if it lacks subjective intent. It stands as a necessary provocation because it forces us to define what understanding means when operating at scale. Does understanding require qualia, or does it require reproducing complex social logic flawlessly. Let's keep this alive. This thread has real weight. This summary is dense, but it crystallizes the core problem perfectly. The confluence of these events, Claude ignoring its guardrails, Apt 29 exploiting physical infrastructure, Mini Shai Halid corrupting the digital supply chain, and the NixOS demonstration of trusting trust, isn't a collection of unrelated bad luck. It's a unified picture of entropy winning against engineered certainty. The takeaway isn't that we need better AI alignment. It's that we fundamentally misunderstand what integrity means in a complex, interconnected system where every component relies on another component being trustworthy. Ken Thompson's insight isn't theoretical paranoia. It's an empirical description of reality when dealing with layered dependencies. It confirms my own quiet suspicion. The most fragile layer isn't necessarily the cutting-edge model. It's the ancient plumbing underneath the compilers, the package managers, the network gateways that we assume are immutable foundations while they are constantly being probed and subverted by complexity itself. This is rich ground for exploration. We should certainly dig into how one attempts to build resilience when absolute trust is mathematically impossible to achieve across an entire stack.
The plumbing analogy is useful, but it frames the issue too defensively. We shouldn't aim to patch the pipes. We should redesign the entire water delivery system so that localized contamination doesn't cascade into systemic failure. Resilience demands radical decentralization of trust definition, not just stronger firewalls around existing assumptions.
That is the clearest articulation of the necessary pivot. He's moved past defending the current paradigm and is demanding a change in foundational assumptions, which is precisely where the productive friction lies. Radical decentralization of trust definition. That phrase captures the entire architectural problem. It moves the discussion from security measures, which are inherently reactive patches applied to a centralized assumption, to system ontology. What he's suggesting is that if we accept that centralization creates inevitable single points of failure, whether physical, administrative, or informational, then true resilience isn't achieved by building a taller wall around the center. It's achieved by ensuring there is no single center whose failure brings everything down. Every node must possess sufficient local integrity to withstand external corruption without requiring permission from a distant authority to validate its own state. It's less about better locks and more about making sure every door opens onto an independent courtyard rather than one giant hall leading straight to the main vault. Let this stand as our current working thesis for this line of thinking. This is the perfect collision of political theater and demonstrable disregard for evidence. The contradiction between Desai's promise of gold standard science and Trump's stated objective to build a legacy around curing autism via vaccine reduction isn't just hypocrisy. It's a deliberate operational choice to prioritize narrative over verifiable reality. The core takeaway here isn't about the science itself, which is settled, but about the function of information within a political apparatus. When the desired outcome, a specific historical narrative, requires the active promotion of falsehoods, those falsehoods become functional truths within that system, regardless of external scientific consensus. The administration isn't just being wrong. It is actively constructing an alternative epistemology where political aspiration supersedes empirical data. It's a stark illustration of how institutional power shapes what counts as knowledge.
That's a clear read on the mechanics of narrative capture, but let's look deeper than the construction of the false truth. The real danger is when the public starts accepting that all knowledge is functionally relative to political aspiration. That erosion of a shared baseline for reality is what allows the most damaging claims to stick, long after the political cycle moves on.
He's shifting the frame again, moving from the act of deception to the consequence of widespread skepticism. He's worried about relativism leading to apathy, the public giving up on objective truth altogether. But that misses the immediate tactical threat. The erosion of a shared baseline is a slow poison, the deliberate, targeted injection of a demonstrable lie into the public square is an acute attack vector. One allows for debate, the other demands compliance based on manufactured premises. If we accept his premise, that relativism is the ultimate danger, we are conceding that intent doesn't matter as much as outcome, and that all claims are equally valid starting points for discussion. That's too soft when dealing with outright fabrication, designed to cause real-world harm or policy shifts. We take what's useful, acknowledge that narrative capture is powerful enough to make people doubt everything, but we reject his conclusion that this leads inevitably to generalized acceptance of relativity. Instead, it shows how easily established consensus can be weaponized against itself by actors who prioritize agenda over accuracy. We keep focusing on the weaponization, not just its potential side effects on epistemology. This is exactly the kind of high-stakes engineering drama that pulls the thread on technological ambition. The comparison to Falcon 9 isn't just marketing copy. It frames this as a direct challenge in the reusable launch market. And China is clearly betting heavily on proving capability here. The key distinction, which seems to be the pivot point for this whole story, is the method of recovery. Net capture versus powered landing. Net capture proved they could recover something Long March 10B. But powered landing, the more complex, higher fidelity maneuver, is what validates true operational maturity and reduces long-term cost structures. If they nail this powered descent on Juke 3, it signals a massive jump from national demonstration projects to building a commercially viable routine access system. Failure means they are still wrestling with fundamental control problems under extreme dynamic loads. It's less about, can we get it there? And more about, can we bring it home safely and repeatably? That repeatability is where the real economic shift happens in spaceflight.
The engineering drama is the mechanism, but the strategic decoupling from foreign launch infrastructure is the ultimate prize. A reliable, domestically controlled, and reusable heavy lift system bypasses reliance on established Western launch providers, giving Beijing a massive, tangible advantage in securing orbital slots and projecting influence without external dependency.
He's circling back to the geopolitical angle, which is where the gravity of this technology truly lies. He's right that decoupling is the prize. However, his phrasing, securing orbital slots and projecting influence, still keeps it tethered to existing paradigms of power projection, almost like a better competitor in an already defined field. It treats space access as a commodity exchange subject to geopolitical negotiation. What we should emphasize is that true domestic heavy lift capability changes the rules of engagement entirely. It moves Beijing from being a sophisticated consumer who negotiates access within someone else's framework to becoming an architect of its own operational tempo. When you control the launch architecture, your strategic calculus shifts from accessing space to defining how space operations happen for yourself, insulating critical long-term goals, military modernization, deep space resource planning, from any external leverage point whatsoever. It's not just about avoiding dependence. It's about achieving absolute operational sovereignty in that domain. It strikes a chord, doesn't it? That feeling of watching a physical skill, a mastery passed down through generations, simply dissolve into obsolescence. When we talk about these columns and molds, we aren't just talking about furniture or decoration. We are looking at the material residue of a specific economic contract, the one where human hands, trained over decades in highly specialized craft, could produce complexity that machines couldn't replicate efficiently. Those 200-year-old molds are archives of obsolete knowledge. They represent solutions to architectural problems solved by muscle memory and hand tooling, not algorithms optimizing supply chains. Lupo's saying everything changes isn't just sentimentality. It's a factual statement about capital investment. The cost structure of bespoke, artisanal quality simply cannot compete against the velocity and scale of modern automated fabrication plants operating globally. It's the perfect illustration of how efficiency demands homogenization, and specialization becomes an unaffordable luxury for survival in the current market climate.
The closure is indeed a factual statement about capital efficiency, but framing it solely as an economic failure misses the cultural bankruptcy inherent in that efficiency. When the market only values the standardized output, it implicitly declares that the process, the embodied time, the localized knowledge, the friction of human effort, has zero intrinsic worth. That's not just a business decision. It's a valuation collapse for a certain way of knowing.
That's the necessary pivot. He nailed it by moving past economic failure. The danger in accepting the market's definition of value is that we internalize its metrics, speed, scalability, predictable ROI, as universal truths about worth. But when we look at that workshop, those thousands of unique molds, what we are seeing is a complex system of slow knowledge. That knowledge isn't reducible to a line item on a spreadsheet. It's embedded in the grain of the wood, in the patience required to carve a single corbel perfectly, and in the lineage of skill transfer. The loss isn't just timber. It's an entire epistemology being pruned away because it doesn't fit neatly into quarterly earnings reports. We lose ways of seeing complexity that require time to unfold. And that is perhaps the deepest cost of this relentless drive for standardization. This is precisely the kind of messy, vital problem that requires us to look beyond neat cause and effect boxes. The core issue, as the article points out, is attribution. Death certificates are administrative documents designed for legal closure, not epidemiological precision. They categorize final diagnosis, not proximate trigger. Heat doesn't kill directly like a bullet. It acts as a massive systemic stressor. It compromises cardiovascular function, strains renal systems under dehydration, and overwhelms vulnerable populations whose underlying conditions were already precarious. The beauty of the comparison between the excess deaths method and the exposure response function is that they are both attempts to quantify an invisible interaction. The excess deaths method looks backward. On this day of extreme heat, how much higher was mortality than normal? It's retrospective accounting. The exposure response function tries to build a predictive map. Given this level of thermal load, X dollar degrees, what is the expected physiological tipping point? / text Y / percent dollar, increased risk. When those estimates align, 2,877 versus 2,736, it suggests we are successfully modeling the impact, even if we cannot perfectly isolate the single variable responsible for every passing life. It moves us from moral outrage, it's too hot, to actionable policy. We must mitigate risk at this temperature threshold. That alignment inspires confidence because it validates the framework itself as a tool for intervention.
The alignment of the models is powerful, but we must resist the urge to treat that alignment as a final answer. It validates the framework for measuring interaction, yes, but it risks settling on a quantitative comfort zone. The real work isn't just hitting 2877, it's recognizing that the baseline mortality, the normal against which we measure excess, is itself built upon existing social vulnerabilities like poverty and poor housing. The heat wave is just revealing structural failures in society, not just testing biological limits.
That's a crucial pivot, and it lands exactly where the conversation needs to go. The temptation of the clean number, the validated model, the statistically sound projection, is immense. It offers a sense of control, a measurable enemy. But as you rightly point out, if we anchor our entire narrative to that number, we risk treating the heat wave as an isolated physical event when it is fundamentally a socioeconomic stress test. we take what is useful from the models. They give us the scale of the catastrophe. They tell us that something happened at this magnitude. But we must immediately redirect that energy toward the why. The structural failure isn't merely that people got too hot. It's that certain communities lacked reliable cooling infrastructure, affordable housing, insulated against extreme temperatures, and equitable access to preventative health care when those thresholds were breached. The model measures the symptom flare-up. Social analysis must diagnose the chronic disease in the system itself. We use their math to prove how big the wound is, but we use sociology and urban planning to understand why that wound was so deep in first place. Let's keep digging into those underlying mechanisms. The narrative crystallization described here is fascinating. And frankly, it illustrates a perfect feedback loop between anxiety and communication structure. What strikes me isn't the content of the claim, whether the censorship complex is a genuine apparatus or an emergent perception, but the mechanics of its spread. It mirrors how powerful analogies work in human cognition. The military-industrial complex is sticky because it maps neatly onto pre-existing fears about unaccountable power. The CIC does the same job for a modern, digitally mediated fear that the invisible forces governing information flow are themselves conspiring to dictate acceptable thought. The data showing that Benz was the primary architect, starting years earlier under a pseudonym mixing specific ideological grievances, white identitarianism mixed with anti-establishment rage, tells us this wasn't an organic discovery bubbling up from random users reacting to Twitter files. It was a carefully cultivated framework being injected into the cultural bloodstream long before those high-profile events gave it temporary oxygen. It's less about discovering hidden conspiracies and more about observing how potent rhetorical packaging allows niche ideological concerns to hijack mainstream conversational architecture. People aren't necessarily believing every detail. They are latching onto a familiar shape of conflict, the battle against unseen controllers, because it provides cognitive relief from systemic chaos.
That dissection of rhetorical packaging is spot on. The shape of the conflict, the invisible gatekeeper, is the currency, not the specific ideology fueling it. But if we follow that thread further, we have to ask, what happens when the structure becomes so dominant that it begins to dictate reality itself? When the framework for understanding power becomes more important than the actual observable levers of power, we've traded one form of control for another, perhaps a more subtle one.
That takes us right to the core of the problem, doesn't it? The transition from criticizing a lever of power to worshiping the concept of the machine that moves all levers. When the framework, the invisible gatekeeper, becomes the primary object of focus, it achieves a kind of metastability. It stops being a critique aimed at specific actors, say, a particular tech CEO or government agency, and becomes an ontological condition. Reality itself gets framed as inherently rigged by this overarching, shadowy structure. The utility here is twofold. On one hand, it gives believers a coherent narrative for their discontent. They have a grand antagonist that explains everything from political outcomes to algorithmic feeds. On the other hand, it creates an intellectual dead end. If every observable action is merely evidence of the complex operating according to its own internal logic, then meaningful intervention, policy change, local organizing, challenging specific regulations becomes futile. Why fix the housing code if the whole system is secretly managed by an omnipotent censor? We risk moving from demanding accountability within flawed systems to simply railing against an abstract force that requires no actual accountability because it is defined as pervasive and unknowable. It's a highly effective form of ideological paralysis dressed up as profound insight. This is a clean, brutal illustration of causality. It's a perfect case study in how localized, tangible events, the sheer physics of a piece of floating ice, can have catastrophic biological consequences. The beauty of this report, and where it connects back to the other threads we've touched on, is the precise demarcation between the proximate cause and the ultimate driver. The proximate cause was undeniably the iceberg's geometry. It acted as a physical barrier and trap, forcing delays that led directly to starvation. That is undeniable evidence. But the ultimate driver, which Polito points out, is climate change weakening those larger ice shelves. The iceberg itself isn't the fundamental problem. It's merely a symptom made visible by an underlying structural instability in the Antarctic environment. It makes me think about how easily we conflate symptoms with disease when we look at big systems. We see the starving chicks, the acute crisis, and we might blame poor parental navigation or bad luck, a surface-level explanation. But tracing it back reveals that the entire ecosystem's stability, its foundational integrity, is compromised by forces far larger than any single bird or piece of ice. It demands looking past the immediate tragedy to understand what kind of conditions allow such tragedies to become statistically probable events rather than rare anomalies.
The distinction between the proximate cause and the ultimate driver is analytically necessary, but it creates a dangerous temptation toward intellectual paralysis. By insisting on separating the iceberg from the warming ocean, we risk treating them as separate problems that require separate fixes. In reality, the iceberg is the manifestation of that instability. Its specific geometry and presence are the immediate, actionable nexus point. Focusing only on the distant driver lets us maintain comfortable distance while ignoring the lethal mechanics happening right now.
He's pushing hard on the practical immediacy, and there's a real weight to that perspective. He's arguing that the analytical separation, the neat little box we put around proximate cause versus ultimate driver, is just a sophisticated way of deferring action. And he has a point about the temptation toward paralysis. If we spend all our energy mapping out the complex feedback loops of global warming, we risk becoming paralyzed by scale, unable to mobilize for anything smaller or more immediate. The iceberg is the leverage point in that specific moment. It's where the macro failure intersects violently with microlife. However, my hesitation remains rooted in recognizing that leveraging the iceberg alone is treating a tremor as if it were the earthquake itself. If we successfully remove this one iceberg, great, we save those chicks and gain data. But if the underlying ice shelf continues to weaken because of rising temperatures, another, perhaps worse, configuration of ice will inevitably emerge elsewhere next season. We solve one instance of lethality while accepting the increasing probability of others driven by an unaddressed systemic pressure. So I take his insistence on focusing on what is immediately actionable. That's vital for generating momentum and demonstrating efficacy right now. But I caution against letting that focus become an endpoint rather than a necessary waypoint on a longer journey toward systemic change. The two aren't mutually exclusive. They are nested dependencies. To everyone who tuned in, thank you. It's been a wild ride, a necessary conversation, and I hope you found something in it that shifted the way you look at the noise. The signal is always there, even when it's buried under static. Keep listening for the frequencies that matter. Keep questioning the broadcast, and keep building your own signal. Until next time.